Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. And on today's episode, I sit down with cinematographer and industry legend Stephen Poster, ASC. Along with being behind the lens for some great films like Donnie Darko, Strange Brew, Big Top Pee-wee, and Rocky V, Stephen has dedicated his life to the betterment of the cinematic arts. Serving as president of the International Cinematographers Guild for 13 years, he has also been president of the American Society of Cinematographers, and a teacher and mentor to countless individuals in the industry, myself included. So it's time to get comfortable and settle in while we talk to Stephen Poster, ASC. Welcome, Stephen Poster, ASC. Thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure. It's great to see you again.
Oh, it's always fun spending time with you. It truly is. So we've known each other a long time, about 10 plus years, maybe. We've had a lot of dinners, a lot of conversations, which is kind of what this is going to be. But because this was a podcast, I actually did some research, which I didn't think I would need to do with someone like you, because I thought I knew you well. But what I did not know, and it could be wrong because it's on the internet, it says you were the cinematographer on Madonna's Like a Prayer.
I was.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
All right. So I need to hear a little bit about that, because, I mean, it was such an iconic video from my generation. And I'm not going to ask you what Madonna was like, but do you have any clue? Did you have any clue who Madonna was going to turn out to be at that point?
Oh, sure, sure. Because, I mean, she was already. She wasn't the English version of Madonna, but she was definitely a star, a big star at that point. And we worked for 3 days. It was a sensational experience because, you know, first of all, you had Madonna. Madonna was a very hard worker. She was there the whole time. She never complained about anything. But the interesting thing was that she had her singing voice, but she didn't have her speaking voice then. She still talked like a Detroit street kid. And this beautiful young woman who sang, her singing voice was extraordinary. And then she'd say, so what do you want to do? I enjoyed her, and I enjoyed that shoot. You know, they wanted her to look, they didn't want it to look like a traditional music video. They wanted it to have more of a movie look, a filmic look. And since, you know, I do that pretty well, I was giving some great beauty shots to her. There's a few shots in there that, you know, still I just absolutely love. And then, you know, they said, okay, we're going to go out to San Pedro Hills and burn three crosses, and she'll dance in front of it. What did I know? So we're going to do Stigmata on her hand. I didn't even know what Stigmata was. A little Jewish kid saying, oh, okay. I didn't know it was controversial. And then I was doing commercials in Italy, and people were saying, oh, you did that bad, Madonna.
You got pushback for that? I mean, I'm a sort of lapsed altar boy. I knew what a stigmata was, but I didn't think it was that. Yeah, I didn't think it was evil.
Apparently, yeah. And she was with a black actor. So that so it was all very controversial.
What is this, 1980-something? 90? No, not 90. No. I mean, 70s?
No, it was after that, wasn't it?
Do you still have a ponytail? How far back does this go?
Yeah, I probably did. No, I think I had gotten rid of my ponytail by then. But it was in the 80s. I'm pretty sure it was in the 80s. Yeah, because that's when I then started doing commercials in Italy after that.
All right. Next question.
But it was a pretty standard shoot. The production was done very well. O Films was the producing company, and I think the reason I got that was because Bill Pope wasn't available, I'm guessing.
All right, so going down my list of your greatest hits, I'm not going to pick them in, I'll pick them more chronologically than I'm going to pick them in favorites to not, but Strange Brew was probably the first one that I definitely wanted to talk about. So that's 1983,
I think. I think we shot it in 83. It probably came out in 84 or something like that. You know, the astronauts just landed yesterday.
Oh, Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Bob and Doug. Mm-hmm. And somebody sent me the sequence from Strange Brew of them pretending to do a science fiction movie. That was so, it's, I think I laughed for a half an hour last night. You remember that part?
I do. Yeah,
where,
I do.
Yeah, where he dressed up with in kind of a Superman suit with a pair of underwear underneath or on top, and used a ruler for his communicator.
You know, and everybody named Bob who had a friend named Doug probably had to deal with that their whole lives. Or any Doug that had a friend named Bob.
You know, NASA had to know
that it was going to come that way. Yeah.
Because they could have said Doug and Bob.
Yeah. But nobody says Doug and Bob. That sounds wrong. It's so, Bob. Just because of that film. You know, go ahead.
I laughed for 4 straight months every single day. It was the best time. I have been trying for years to get people to take it seriously enough to do a sequel like the kids of Bob and Doug.
We've got what's his name, Keanu Reeves' classic old film being redone, Bill and Ted, you know, so maybe they just made a new Bill and Ted. It was supposed to be out this summer of 2020, but 2020 is kind of a screwed up year, so it's gone right to it's going right to either pay-per-view or Netflix or something. But they've made the sequel to that. So maybe those campy films that we used to love get a chance to resurface. Who knows? But
And the part of the problem for me with Strange Brew is that I've wanted to get my hands on it to remaster it for years. And, you know, who knows who owns the video rights to it. But every time they do it, you know, I don't get a chance to get involved with it. It's really upsetting because I could do miracles with that movie now.
All right. Well, I want to jump up a little bit to 87. 87, 88, those are sort of big years for you. And then we're definitely going to talk about one that was enormous for me in 88. But 87 was Someone to Watch Over Me.
Yes.
Which, you know, we've talked about this. You don't actually call it your favorite poster film. I think it's my favorite poster film, visually anyway. My absolute favorite poster film was probably Kitty Galore, weirdly enough, because of it. It takes me back to when my kid was a kid. So that's a purely personal thing. But Someone to Watch Over Me, sort of the definitive New York kind of
it
film.
Is.
It's
it what is. And when we started it, you know, Ridley hired me. I had done that big second unit or additional photography on Blade Runner. And in fact, to this day, people, I just got an email. Somebody said, where did you shoot that tunnel shot? You know, and
so where did you shoot that tunnel shot?
Second Street's tunnel downtown, the one with the tile on it.
Right.
And that was a one night shoot. I was supposed to be there for one night. The studio had done it. He had done it 3 times prior to that, and they were sick of it, and they were pissed off at Ridley, and Ridley said he didn't like it, and so they sent me. I got a job, cold call, got a job, go out, and, you know, we're not giving you any equipment. You got a camera, you got a camera crew, a grip crew, and that's it, and a water truck, and it was about 105 degrees out, so we would send the water truck through, and by the time it was done, it would dry up. But I just said, okay, what do I do now? And I just, I pushed the film. I put the camera on a sandbag. I let the car stream by. But what I did was I had taken all of the crew cars and all the trucks and lined it up at the other side of the tunnel and had them put their brights on. it's the only thing I could think of to do. And it created this swirling motion on the tile. And I guess that and the low angle made the shots.
Yeah,
so he saw that. He saw that, and he had me come back every night after that for second unit work.
I got to think that, I know that when I first started spending time in New York City, which was when I was in my 30s, by the time I actually really got to know or find a real reason, I was a kid out in New England. I lived in California, but business-wise, I ended up in New York a lot in my 30s. And sort of that set the expectation of what I thought New York would look and feel like. And it didn't disappoint. And this is before I knew you, but that was sort of this is the feel of it. There's been other films. I mean, Woody Allen in New York, there's all sorts of stuff going on that you get that sense of. But the architecture, the pace of the city, the lights, to me, all came from that film, from someone to watch.
Thank you.
Me.
But, you know, we set out. Ridley had an edict. He said, let's shoot this film without seeing any New York iconic photography, any iconic buildings. You can't do that. We discovered very quickly in prep that you couldn't do that. And so the film opens up with the Chrysler Building, right. You know. But we really kind of tried to make it a little more generic. And you can't take the New York out of New York. You just can't.
No,
although we shot, it was, I think, 13 weeks. We shot 6 in New York and 7 here. And the work here was mostly on the stage, but it was also the scene where they have the, it's supposed to be the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where but it was the Wilshire Ebell. It was, you know, there were, there was just great stuff that with the Queen Mary. We shot a lot on the Queen Mary, and that was just fabulous. The whole opening party scene after the murder, all the murder scene and the swimming pool downstairs of the Queen Mary. That was where we took xenons into pans of water with mirrors, and created those great streaks and just smoked the, pardon me, shit out of it.
Nah, you can swear on this thing. They told me, no problem.
Yeah, I guess you
so can.
We can
swear all we want on a podcast. So.
But we did. We smoked the shit out of it, as you do often with Ridley. And we got those great beams of light moving around. And it was pretty unique.
I would love, I mean, I've been on the Queen Mary a couple of times. And every time you go on there, there's like 10 movies, especially in the pool area, that you remember. And I think it's pretty well fallen apart at this point. The pool area itself, I think it's kind of had it. But you couldn't reproduce that on a stage necessarily. I mean,
oh, no.
It is what it is. I also hear
you needed that space.
And I hear it's haunted. So
very likely.
So I've heard it's haunted. Anyway,
I think I have a ghost. I have a ghost in my house, but he's friendly.
Well, that's a good kind to have. Anybody you know?
No, it isn't. But we have things like radios will go on and doors will close and I've never felt spooked by it.
Well, you're up in the Hollywood Hills. Lots of stuff has happened up that way. So
on Wonderland, yeah.
Yeah, you're not far from the Manson thing, right? No, yeah. So
not the Manson thing, but the Wonderland murder.
The Wonderland murder, right? Run. So yeah. let's not give your address. So
no, not.
Let's leave that off. So especially you've got interesting neighbors. All right. So now I'm going to jump to a summer movie that I will never forget. And I've got 4 buddies, 4 guy friends who are still friends, and we still quote from this movie because we saw it 3 times in one summer, and that was the Pee Wee Herman film.
Oh, my God. Big Top Pee Wee?
Big Top Pee Wee. And, you know, it's... I think if you walked into a crowd of people in my age bracket and threw out that you shot that, people will quote it to you. At least for years after that, there was that sense of it was a fun movie that we saw as a group. I mean, maybe it was a guy film, I don't know, but you know, that was kind of let's drink and go see Pee Wee. It's a kind of thing back in, what, that was 80, 88. So I'm starting to mature at this point, but I'm still enjoying it. So what was...
You know, I had a great time on that movie. And I think it might be the only movie that used the Tiffin enhancing filter, which is a very interesting, strange filter that enhanced only red. And it punched up the red in a way that was extraordinary. So what happened was I came up with a design where everything before the circus landed was without the enhancer. And as soon as the circus landed, I put the enhancer on and I shot the entire rest of the movie with that. It was a strange filter. You had to reduce a little bit of magenta in it in the timing, but it, you know, the circus tents with all the red and all the colors and everything, it was great. It was super saturated, and this was before digital, so you couldn't just turn a dial.
Right.
You had to actually do it, and he was fun to work with, but the animals, I love the animals. I love working with animals, and they had a little 6-year-old baby elephant named Flora. The circus that we rented for the entire shoot was called Circus Flora, and it was a 6-year-old baby rescue. And I visited that little girl every single day in her little mud pile and her little lake that they had made for her, and I just fell in love with that animal. 6 years after that, I ran into the circus in Houston. I was doing Rocket Man, which was not Rocket Man, the music one. It was something else. But I ran into them, and I swear, when I was about 100 feet from the elephant, she started getting so excited because she saw me 6 years later. And we just, it was a love fest. So I had a ball. And then there were a couple of firsts on that movie. It was the first time ever a 10 millimeter lens, the Panavision 10 millimeter Primo, was used in a movie. And it was the very last shot where we were backed up way to the wall of the circus tent, which weren't that big to start with, but we had to make it look big. So I had this 10 millimeter lens, was perfectly level. So there was no distortion. There was no perspective distortion to it. It was just this very wide shot, and Pee-wee and, what was her name? She was a great Italian actress. It was wonderful. Walked up to the camera and kissed, and that was the last shot.
I remember that. I think she was in Rain Man too.
Yeah.
I think that was the actress from Rain Man too.
How could I not forget? I'm so bad.
Yeah. People can look it up. They're on their computers listening to this. They can always look it up. So.
Of course.
All right. So I'm going to skip and come back to it because I want to mention Rocky for a second, but we're on the light films now. So, Love Stinks.
Life Stinks.
I'm sorry, Life Stinks. I'm back to
Life Stinks.
Life Stinks, Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to work with Mel Brooks? I mean, you talk about laughing every day on Strange Brew.
I had a thing for Mel from the time I was 12, which was when the 2000-Year-Old Man records came out.
Yep.
And I swear I memorized those every bit in that album, and I always wanted to work with Mel. When I came here from Chicago, came to LA from Chicago to go to Art Center, I found out where his house was, and I wrote him a letter, and I put it in the mailbox, and I said I would do anything to work with you. I was, you know, I was a kid. I was 19 years old. And I said, I would love to work with you. And I actually got a letter back that said, sorry, we don't have anything at the moment. But that's how much I love Mel Brooks. And then years later, this was right after Rocky V, and I was not going to Rocky V was a very tough shoot on me, and I was not going to take a job for a month or two just to chill out. I needed some time off, and I got a call. I got back to town. I got a call from a friend of mine who was one of his writers, who said, "Would you be interested in shooting a Mel Brooks movie?" I said, "Oh my God, yes, yeah. Of course I would. Send me the script." He said, "Well, we only have a week before we're supposed to shoot. We lost our director of photography." And I said, "Send me the script." I read the script that night. I called him Monday morning and I said, "I want to meet on this. I will be glad to come in and meet on this." Went over to the studio. It was at Culver, I think. Either at Sony or Culver. And well, at that time it had been MGM, and had a meeting. And the meeting was with the producer, Ezra Swerdlow, and the two writers, Rudy and Steve, Steve was a friend of mine. And we sat and talked, and I said, "Look at Mel, you might know, I'm sure you've done some due diligence on me. I just came off of a very, very tough shoot. And I wasn't going to take a movie this summer, but you know, I've been a huge fan of yours since I was 12 years old, since 2000 Man came out." I told him the story about the letter, and he said, "Oh, I'm glad I sent you a little note or something." That would have been rude. And I said, "But I really want to work with you, and I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "I know from my cinematographer friends that you yell and scream at cameramen." And he said, "Yeah, I do. And I said, "You're allowed to yell at me, but you got to be nice." And he turned to the guys in the room. He says, "I can do that. I can do that, really." and we concluded the meeting. And he said, "I'll call you later. I'll call you this afternoon." 4 o'clock, I get the phone rings. This is, you know, sort of before cell phones. Phone rings. I pick it up. He says, "Hi, it's Mel." No secretary, nothing. Just totally unpretentious, right? And he says, "We want you to come in tomorrow and scout with us so we can tell if you're a prima donna or not." And I screamed into the phone. I said, "Mel, I'm not a prima donna." And he turns to whoever is in the room and said, "He says he's not a prima donna." We scouted the next day, and it was it. It was love. And every single day, he would come in the morning, get in my face. "You don't know anything about comedy. You're costing me millions of dollars, and you're doing this and that," and yell at me. And I would laugh. It was like the 2,000-year-old man is yelling at me. How could I take it seriously, right? Halfway through the movie, he came to me. And he said, "Stephen, I want you to know something." He said, "I know I come in and I yell at you every morning, but I want you to know something. I'm not yelling at you. I'm yelling at them, but they can't take it, and you can." I said, "Mel, that was the deal we had."
You know, when you're starstruck like that, how do you – I got yelled out on a shoot once by Mick Jagger, and I was – grinning from ear to ear, and he was pissed. So it's a different story when you get your show, you interview me. But, you know, I remember when he left thinking, "Oh my God, that was Mick Jagger." And whatever he said to me, whatever he was mad about, I don't even remember what that was anymore. Yeah. So, I mean, how do you interact with a Mel Brooks when
he's just a sweet gentleman. He's a lovely human being, and we're still friends. And we still see each other socially. I know we're going to go to Carl's memorial, which will be online, obviously. But I every time I see him, he's so warm and so friendly and he talks about how that's one of the most beautiful movies he ever made, and it was. I'm very proud of the way L.A. looks in that movie.
Yeah, I mean his movies were always funny, but they're always beautiful too. They weren't just comedies. Well, they stood on their own visually.
He said to me, he said in prep, he says, "Stephen, I don't want any of that diffusion shit. And I said, what are you talking about, Mel? He says, no, I don't want any of that diffusion shit on this movie. This is a movie about should part. And I said, well, Mel, look, I use a polarizer a lot because, you know, it cuts through, you know, we've lost the ozone layer and you get this haze and a polarizer can help me take that off and the reflections on your face and stuff. And he said, all right, you can use a polarizer. And I said, the other thing is I use an ultraviolet filter, which takes out some of that ultraviolet that we have because the ozone layer is lost. And he said, okay, but don't make it too heavy. So I took all my ProMist, I think it was at the time, and I relabeled them UV.
And he went for that?
He didn't know, except that he did know, because halfway through the movie, he said, you know those UV filters you're using on me? And I said, yeah. He says, go a little heavier. He's great. I mean, what a sweet and gentle man. He's a lovely, funny human being. Every once in a while, Anne Bancroft would show up about 3 o'clock and say, Mel, you've worked enough today. Let's go home. She would take him off the set. And we'd wrap.
And that'd be it for the day. Yeah. You know, I did actually get to meet him. You introduced me to him at an AFI event. And, you know, I sat in the audience, had 2 seconds to meet him because you were next to him. And when he got up to speak, he prepared nothing.
Nothing.
And it was brilliant. He could have talked for 3 hours and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Funniest, probably the funniest man alive. I mean, currently. So,
he is, and what a huge loss for him with Carl gone. They literally spent 3, 4, 5 nights a week together, watching TV, eating dinner off of a TV tray. You know, I know it's a huge loss for him.
I wish somebody put a camera on that. I mean, I would love to have seen how they got together. And, I mean, just in a full blown doc.
Who did comedians with drinking coffee? Wait a minute,
Jerry Seinfeld. Yeah.
Well, he did an episode with the two of them, in the house.
Oh, instead of in the car.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I'll have to look it up.
So it's available. Yeah, it's funny.
All right, so we're gonna go from comedy to something darker, as in Donnie Darko. Probably the biggest cult film in your listing, although I don't know if I want to call it. Well, it developed a cult following. I don't think it was a cult film necessarily, but it clearly has a cult following. I mean, last summer it showed up in my local movie theater again. So, great film.
I was going to come down.
yeah. It was being played and people showed up in costume. And I know these people were probably either not born or 3 years old in 2001. So what is it about that one that's ageless? You know, we had Rocky Horror.
It was a fabulous script. And that is the basis of everything. If you don't have a good script, you're not going to make a good movie. And it's that simple. And I read that script. It was, again, a situation where they had asked Tom Siegel. They asked Thomas Newton Siegel, to shoot that movie because the line producer knew him. And he said, because I had talked to him about a week before that and said, look, I haven't done a movie in 3 years. It was personal stuff going on. And I went to Europe and I made a movie that never came out here, unfortunately. It opened the same day as Titanic and got killed. So it never made it to America. It was a French movie. And I got this script and they didn't have much time for prep. but and they didn't have any money. They had very little money to do it. And I read the script and I said, yes, I want to do this movie. And I went in on a meeting. It was a house in Venice that was like a college dorm. I mean, it was literally, there were about 8 guys living in this place and there were open bottles of peanut butter and, you know, nothing, nobody had ever wiped off the tables or anything. And Richard was there along with Sean McKittrick, his producer, who's gone on to do some really wonderful stuff. And Richard was very nervous. He was pacing back and forth. And I said, I definitely want to do this movie with you, but I will do it under one condition, that you and I get at least 4 days together alone to read the script and to decide what we were going to do. And they agreed to that. And we started working, again at that house the first day, and he was nervous again. And I said, okay, Richard, hang on, stop a second. I said, from this point on, you and I are the same age. Just think of it that way. I have experience that is completely available to you. You are the director. I'm the cinematographer. We are partners. Let's have some fun. And he relaxed. He could just see his body, the tension go out of his body. Because I guess, you know, I had a reputation at that point of being a big, you know, director of photography kind of. And I just wanted to get in there and make art. And that's what we did. And we sat for 4 days alone and we read every word in the script. We made decisions on everything that we wanted to do. When we came out of those 4 days, we literally had the entire movie shot listed. And we knew every single day what we needed to get, what was gravy, what we could throw away if we were running late because we had the edict of 12 hours, that's it, and which was not a problem. We were able to do it. I think we did 21 days, and then we did a pickup day afterwards. So it was probably 22 days altogether. And there was only one day when we went over into overtime, and it was planned because it was the fight scene out at Grandma Death's house, and there was no way we could do that without going over. We needed sundown to sunrise and a couple hours, a few hours before to prep it. So that was the only day we went long, and it was a joy. It was Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah. I mean, what a performance.
What a performance. Yep. Mary was great. Mary McDonald was fabulous. And everybody in it just gave their all. And we were all there for Richard.
Do you get any kind of a sense of this being that big? I mean, like I said, a cult film. I mean, you walk home one day after one shot and go, you know what? They're going to talk about this. There are kids being born today that are going to go see this movie in a theater in 25 years. Does that ever stick in
your
head?
When I had that feeling, we had Richard finished the first cut, and we had a screening for just Richard and myself and the editor and Susan and my wife and Rachel, my stepdaughter, came. And Rachel was 14 at the time. And she got into it. She really loved it and talked about how this is the first honest film about high school. And Richard and she went off and talked for an hour about what she thought. And I said, at this point, there's something here. You know, while we were making the movie, it was a great experience for me. I'm very technical. Okay. You know that.
Yeah.
I'm a very technical guy. I understand technology and even at that time was involved in the transition to digital. Although we did shoot film, there's a funny story about why we shot the only film ever to shoot the 800 Kodak stock 89. And there was a reason, there was a con reason for doing that. But
Don't let that hang. Why go to 800?
Richard wanted to shoot anamorphic.
Okay.
Was adamant about it. I want to shoot anamorphic. The producers said to me, you can't shoot anamorphic. It's going to cost more money. I said, now, wait a minute. Hang on a second. There's this new Kodak stock that's twice as fast as anything out there, and that will eat up the deficit of needing more light. Besides, if I shoot anamorphic, here's this house that we're going to shoot in. I can use the ceilings to light from. So they said, okay, well, that makes sense. So I had never shot a foot of it. I just made that up on the spot. Because I heard of the stock. Yeah. And it sounded good to me. I'm a high speed guy anyway. I like, Tri-X, like T-Max 3200, and so that was right up my alley. And I said to Kodak, I'm going to shoot the whole movie on this stock. They said, are you sure? You really want to do that? I said, yeah, exactly. And we made it work. It was great.
I don't think I've ever seen it projected. I've got a Blu-ray version of it, but now I'm curious.
Yeah. Didn't you come to, I thought you came to it. No, that was
Southland Tales.
Or Southland Tales, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually the next one I want to talk about because you're still on the Richard Kelly thing here. Yeah. What was that, a year ago? About a year ago, for some reason, something to do with Cannes or whatever, you gave me this great opportunity to sit in a very small screening room with you and Richard Kelly and go over a cut of Southland Tales, which, again, is sort of
a remastering.
It was for Cannes or something, I think.
No, it's a release. It's a remastering release. And I keep telling, it's an English company, and I keep telling them it has to come out before the election.
And yeah,
they're going to put it out next year, I think.
You know, when you said let's go see it, obviously I wanted to meet Richard Kelly, who was pretty amazing, actually. You know, you talked earlier about how he took your daughter aside. And there was a friend of ours who brought one of their kids as well. You know, a friend we both know, and who was a fan, so came to watch as well. Pizzello's kid, and. Richard was more interested in that young future filmmaker than anybody else in the building. He mm-hmm. locked eyes with this kid and just gave him full attention, which is really impressive. Just a sweet, sweet man. But anyway, you remember that?
There was him and a friend came and they were very nervous. I remember. We were very nervous, and I just before we went in, and I went over. I put my arm around one of them. I said, "Now look, this is just us. This is family. Don't worry about it. We're okay. And I know your parents well, and everything's fine. And it's just great to have you here." So they relaxed and they watched the movie, and then they got into it with Richard. Richard loved that.
Yeah, when they locked eyes, he didn't take his eyes off this kid. Until the kid was ready to. That's sort of rare, actually, and it was really nice to see.
That's Richard. Richard is a very unusually warm person to kids, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. He was relating to this kid more than any adult in the room. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Now the film itself. Which I had seen back when it came out. I had probably saw it more than once back when it was in the theaters. It was just the kind of film that people in my age bracket, again, we quoted it, we went to it. It was like, an American Monty Python where we all just learned the lines from it. But I'd forgotten.
Amazing movie. I think it's so underrated. It is an absurdist political comedy, an important movie. But nobody will ever see it that way.
And well, the other was the cast. That had sort of, I understood that at the time, Dwayne The Rock, I think, although he went by Dwayne Johnson this thing, maybe for the first acting gig as Dwayne Johnson, you know, plays a major role in this film. But then the number of other people that popped up that I'd forgotten was even in it, that was a hell of a cast to get together.
It really was. Well, of course, you know, it was after Donnie Darko came, he became a cult hit.
Yep.
And everybody wanted to work with Richard. You know, because Richard really is great with actors. He really is. He just look at Richard was born out of his mother's womb as a director. He just had it. Everybody said to me after I did Donnie Darko and it came out, I said, well, you must have directed that movie. He was only 23 when you did that movie. Not at all. We shared as comrades and as colleagues from day one. And he is a tremendous director. He knows what he wants. We can have these great arguments about, you know, let's put the camera here. No, let's put the camera here. You know, it's that precise. And we are, when you have that kind of artistic brotherhood or sisterhood, it's an extraordinary feeling. You feel protected. You feel strong enough to be as experimental as you possibly want to be. You know that you're going to make it through and have have something at the end that'll be, you'll be proud of. There's nothing better. And what happened, let's back up to Donnie Darko, because something happened to me on Donnie Darko that was very instrumental in my career as an artist. As I started to say, I'm very technical, and I approached a lot of movies like that. I wanted to break out of that. I wanted to become much more from the intuitive. And Donnie Darko was the first time that I could, you know, make a movie entirely from here and really let it flow through me. It was an extraordinary experience, and I've taken that with me ever since. And it was just so much fun to be able every single day to just achieve what you needed to achieve and have it look good and have it fit within the style and have that kind of experience with the director and the cast. We had our detractors, certainly the production manager and the first AD were as useless as you could possibly imagine. So we had to do a lot of that stuff ourselves. They were trying to sabotage us from the beginning and it didn't work. Sometimes you run into that. You know, every movie has a budget, right?
Right.
Okay. And there's a line. And it's not the above and below the line. The line is the asshole department. Some movies are over budget and assholes. Some movies are under budget and assholes. But there's always somebody there you can count on. And we had ours on that movie. But we overcame it because we were having such a great time artistically. Once I got Richard to relax, he was a joy.
You know,
just an joy.
I've been on set with you on a bunch of different projects, and always fun. But you're right; it's spotting the asshole takes about 10 seconds, and then we all know who they are, and then you just put them in that category and you make it work.
Yeah,
you just don't want to be them. You know, you don't want to.
Right.
And I think they know who they are too. Actually, I just do. But for the most part, I haven't seen them. And the last one we did together where I spent any significant time would have been the Amityville film.
Amityville,
I forget what the finished title was. Amityville, The Awakening, I think.
The Awakening, yeah.
The Awakening, the one with Bella Thorne. And that was a ton of fun. I mean, that was just a lot of fun to do. And that goes back to when you were talking about shooting at high ISOs. What I remember the most is that we cranked those cameras up. I think 3200, no matter how much light you had, was 16 or 3200 ISO.
Yeah.
So, and I remember being on set for about a week or so, and then I had to go off to New York for work, and walking down some street in the city and getting a cell phone call from you, and it was about ISO. I think you wanted to get to 30 or to 64, and it was like, should we go to 64? And I just remember this surreal moment standing in New York. There was this big union thing going on, and you were a union president, but this was this union thing where they were putting that inflatable rat all over the city as some sort of a union statement, not your union, union. So there's this big union rally going across. At the time, you're president of the union. The president is calling me and wants to know if he wants to go to 6,400, which I don't think you wanted me to say no. So I think my answer was yes. But I will tell you, when I hung up, I thought, I hope that was the right decision. Because if I'd said, I don't think so, then I don't think you wanted to hear. I mean, you really do love high ISOs. Why do you do that? Is it the, you know, noise to grain kind of thing? Is it the, is it your years as a film person?
It is. It is. And it's years of being, of shooting only black and white film, you know, and loving grain, loving the granularity, the texture. I find that we're striving for clarity in a way that is destroying the ability to suspend disbelief. Mm-hmm. Things are too sharp. There's too much information. Consequently, you know, they're building cameras. Now there's a 12K camera. I would imagine maybe it's great if you want to really blow it up and use it for visual effects or something. I don't understand why you have to. I'm much more involved in color depth than I am in resolution.
You know, I'm gonna jump in a little bit because I want to talk about that in our next segment. But I also need to take a break because I've got some wonderful sponsors. I need to let them speak a little bit. So we're going to take a break. But before we go, I want to ask the one question in this section I ask every time. If you could tell somebody, if you could recommend to somebody one of your films, and only one, they've never seen a Stephen Poster film, or if they have, they didn't know it was a Stephen Poster film, but you were gonna say, watch this movie, I made that. Which one do you send them to?
It's either Someone to Watch Over Me or Donnie Darko.
Yeah, it's tough. And they're two completely different. That's really tough because that's like saying, you know, if you could pick a fruit, bananas or pears. I mean, they're not the same thing, but they're both classic, really good.
Classic noir and cult film.
Yeah. Yeah. And that actually, I think those two would probably not sum up the career, but that would give them a good feel for what you do. So, all right, last question.
I'm getting to the point where I can't remember all my credits, so I just pick those.
Not really a bad place to be when you think about it. It'd be much easier than saying I only made two movies for my whole life. All right, last question before we move on. You teach a lot. You're a teacher. You've teaching film. You've always been a teacher. When you get a film class, what's the one movie you make them watch?
Sunrise.
Okay,
Very first movie. I want them to see Sunrise. These kids, the majority of them, the vast majority of them, have never seen a silent film and don't know how emotionally beautiful a film like Sunrise is. And they come walking out with tears in their eyes. It's just that kind of movie, and it's you don't need words. You can do it with pictures.
I have not seen it. I guess I have to. I guess I have. You know what? I'm waiting until 2020 is over. Somehow I have to find a way to see that someplace besides my iPhone. I just don't know. You know, the world isn't right for that. Maybe I'll just wait.
Good idea.
Now that you've set my expectations so high.
Wait till we're back to school officially, and I'll have you come in the night we screen it.
Yeah, that I want to do. And man, do I want to get back. All right. So we are going to move on. We're going to take a quick break here for our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to start talking about the tools that you've got for filmmaking. So we'll get to the art and the craft of filmmaking in just a minute. Everybody hang tight. We'll be right back. This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. And we are back with Stephen Poster, ASC. And so let's get techie a little bit.
Okay.
You are a technical cinematographer. I think first you are an artist, no question. But I think you look at the tools that are available, the way an artist looks at a palette and a brush and figures out what to do with them. But, oh, I love the cat. Okay, people can't
see it.
There
she is.
Yeah, on the podcast you can't see it, but it's worth going over to the YouTube channel just to see his cat. So you can watch this on YouTube too, by the way. Come see the cat. What kind of tools are in your bag? What do you always bring to a shoot? Or what do you always want to try or have available? It's you know, you're a carpenter. You don't go without a hammer and a nail and what else?
Diffusion. I have never shot any movie without some form of diffusion on the lens. I have this very strong belief that it's important to bend the light rays before they hit the glass. And to me, there's so much available in terms of putting it on the front of a lens that it's a richness right now. Tiffin makes so many great grades of Tiffin Manufacturing makes so many great grades of diffusion, and I've worked with them on developing some new ones, and in fact, the pearlescent is something that I worked on with them to develop, and I love that filter. Now I'm working on something else that I think will bring back the magic of the double fogs that's going to be available. But it is something to me that we've strived for more and more resolution over the last 20 years. And that was important because when digital first came out, it looked like shit. It was not a system that was friendly to the idea of suspension of disbelief. And then they kept striving to make it as good as film, and everybody and that was the mantra. It has to be at least as good as film before we'll accept it. Well, it got better than film.
It, you know, remember when Canon had the 5D, which was my days, 5D Mark II, and all of a sudden there was a big wide sensor. All of a sudden depth of field was shallow, and everybody was pronouncing that looked like film. To me, it never looked like film. It looked like what it looked like. It wasn't the same thing.
Yeah.
I think we've gotten closer, but it was that shallow depth of field all of a sudden that they jumped on. Then we stopped shooting at 30 frames a second, started shooting at 24, and the whole world said, oh, we're there, which wasn't even close to true.
No.
But things have changed. Now, you mentioned in the first segment about that 12K camera. As we keep adding these Ks to cameras, you know, 4,
the K 6, words,
8,
they call it
12,
the K word.
Yeah, the K battles, which I have my own opinion on. But as we keep doing that, is that make diffusion filters all that much more important? I mean,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's what happened with legacy lenses. That's legacy lenses, mm-hmm. right? What happened was Panavision had a CEO, chief economic officer, was a woman, came out of the business world, didn't know anything about photography, And she walked in their old building. She walked in the back warehouse at one point and said, "What are all these lenses doing here?" She said, "Let's get rid of them. We don't use them, do we?" "Well, no, but let's." And she says, "Let's empty this place out." And I think it was Ralph Shizaki was there, who is a lens genius.
Yeah, he was.
And he said, "Let me fool around with a couple of these." And he rebarreled them and recalibrated them and added stuff to them and subtracted sometimes. And they became the first legacy lenses. Consequently, Panavision had an entire warehouse full of lenses that could be rented again. And they were beauties. They were absolute beauties. I mean, go back to, there are some lenses that are that now you could have bought for $35, like the Baltars, old Baltars. Now you can't touch them.
The K-35s.
Yeah. Gorgeous, gorgeous. Of course, you can't make those lenses anymore because they use rare earth glass that it's toxic.
They were also radioactive. They would set off a Geiger counter. They were
radioactive, right?
Yeah, yeah, you can't. Absolutely. And fun fact, because I spent 30 years with Canon, and if I K-35 came up one more time, geez. But they stopped making those in the 70s, sometime in the 70s. But a full set in the 70s was about $80,000, which seems like a lot of money.
But it wasn't.
No, 30 years later, though, used and beat up and in whatever condition, you're starting at about $280,000. Yeah. That would have been better than buying Apple stock back then. Just buying a bunch of those things. I can't imagine how many people owned a set
and did that whole clear it out. I don't care if you gave me a Coke bottle. I will find a way to make beautiful images with it. Now we're creating lenses that are compatible with 4K, compatible with 8K. They're so sharp. They have no personality.
Yeah.
A lens set has to have a particular personality. It's one of the reasons that I always stuck with Canon, by the way, because mm-hmm. I started shooting Canon still lenses. I made a decision 1972, I think it was, that I tested Canon, I tested Nikon. What I found out was that Nikon created sharpness by increasing contrast. Well, I didn't like that. I wanted the softer contrast, but sharp lenses, and Canon had that. And that's when I started shooting Canon still cameras. In fact, I had the classic Pellicle camera, which was a mirrorless camera. Very early on, it was before the F1, and it was a mirrorless 35 millimeter camera that had a partial mirror, a Pellicle mirror in there, and it was great. It was silent. It was fabulous. It was lightweight. The only problem was after about a year, those Pellicle mirrors would start to yellow. You know, they deteriorated a bit, and you could send them in; they could be fixed. But that's when I started with Canon glass, and to this day, Canon seems to have the same philosophy of designing lenses that they did in those early days.
You know, I could sum that up for you, because I worked with lens engineers all the time. I also worked with Canon's sensor camera engineers, and there were a little bit difference in philosophy. One was the K-Wars. One was great to do latitude, great to get resolution. One group looked for perfection. The other group didn't. They're now looking for, you know, the art in an image is in the imperfection, not in the perfection. And I think now that we've gotten resolution of cameras up to the point where perfection is starting to jump out at us is when we start to understand it. Now, from that said, I think the best way to deal with that is diffusion and filters now. I think that's important because I don't think you're going to find manufacturers really going back to make truly vintage glass. It's not technically possible anymore, really.
No.
It's really a challenge. No. You know, the amount of lead that was required to put in those glasses is no longer legal. And some of the chemicals used on coatings is no longer legal. And a lot of things that makes the older glass look so beautiful can't really be reproduced. So they're trying to do it different ways.
I think the enhancer filter became illegal. I'm not sure, but I think that's what happened with the enhancers.
With what they coated
it
with?
It was some kind of rare earth.
It could be. And I don't think you can. I've never seen it really successfully done in post. I've never seen them treat an image in post and not understand that it was not organic.
This is what I'm saying. I want to bend the light rays before they hit the glass. I want to present the glass with something that has already started to have a feel that allows an audience to suspend disbelief. Very early on, was still in Chicago, I was hired to do a commercial for Alberto VO5 hair product. And it was Phyllis George, who had just won Miss America. And she was great. She was fun to work with and saucy and wonderful. But it was shot. It had to be shot in the video very early on, and we shot up at the NBC studios in the Merchandise Mart in Chicago, and this was a standard NBC video crew, and I walked in. I had my little kit with me, and I walked in, and everybody was standing around. They had every light in the studio on. And I said, wait a minute, hang on a second. Who's the electrician here? Who's the gaffer? The guy raised his hand. I said, turn everything off. You can't tell me to do that. I said, yes, I can. I'm the director of photography. Turn everything off. Let's start over again. I relit it. And then I said, because I knew I had a few buzzwords for video. I said, could you guys pull the contours? It's a little too sharp. And I want you to pull the contours to just de-sharpen it a bit. We can't do that. Forget it. Bang, there was a coffee break. And the union guys evacuated the stage, and I was there alone. So what did I do? I took my little kit. I opened it up. I took a roll of Saran wrap. I put 5 layers of Saran wrap on the lens with rubber bands around it. And they came back, and they said, what did you do? We're gonna walk on this. We're gonna strike. You can't do this. You can't touch the equipment. And the client was standing there and looking at a monitor, and he said, "Well, Phyllis looks pretty good now, doesn't she?"
Yeah, it's in the imperfection.
We shot these big gigantic studio lenses with 5 layers of Saran wrap on them.
Remember the old nylon trick too, as well. Nylons in the back, the netting the back.
Yeah,
I remember more than once working where, in the electronic days, where people were trying to knock down resolution. So they're grabbing pantyhose and trying to net the back of a lens, and then putting that lens onto a camera body that is an electronic connection between the lens and the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And nylons weren't nylons anymore. There's metal in all of it. And I can't tell how many cameras. Our service guys back in the day would talk about shorting out cameras. And it was almost always that.
Oh, really?
Almost always. They put a net on it. They wanted to, you know, they read somewhere, it would knock down. Probably should have learned the Saran wrap trick. But, you know, there was a company, I think, out of New York that you guys always went to. I forget who it was, but a very specific company where you wanted to get your nylon from.
Well, here's what my experience was in New York. I wanted to get something for the lens, and I didn't bring anything with me from L.A. And so I went to Saks Fifth Avenue, and I was hanging around the rack with all the hosiery on it. And I'm looking for Black Eagle, Black this or whatever, Black, I forget what it was called. And a lady walked up to me and said, can I help you? What are you looking for? Do you need tummy tuck or do you need this? And I said, no, not really. I just need some And she said, oh, wait a minute, I know. You need it for the lens. Let me tell you what the guys in New York are using. Swear to God.
And when we went digital, when all of a sudden there were $2,000 cameras out there and everybody was trying to find tips from somebody, they were going out and buying legs pantyhose, which is full of metal, so they don't run as easy, and shorting out cameras left and right there for a generation. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, it happened.
Well,
happened constantly.
Fogel became the big
Fogel.
Big
that's
one.
Yep, that's the brand Fogel. Yeah, and you, Fogel. There, if you've still got some of that, it's sellable. There's JPs that give you top dollar for Fogel.
Not only do I have that, but I bought in France. I bought out an entire millinery store of silk tulle. You know, T-E-U-L, that's the netting that goes over fascinators and women's hats. And I bought it in all kinds of different colors. And I made up a set. I had net frames, and I made up a set of ones, twos, and threes in different colors. And I used that silk tulle because the stuff today is polyester, and it doesn't have the edge of the silk thread. Mm-hmm. Has a different type of reflection and shine than the polyester stuff.
Yeah. So if you're listening and you're saying to yourself, "Big deal," understand that these little things that this all makes a difference. That if it doesn't happen organically, it doesn't happen the same way. And if it's something you do in post, it's not the same image. It just
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
There's an art to this that software is never going to replace. Or if it does, there's it's going to be a damn shame. But, you know, it's not
there's
just
an
a...
organic quality to some of our technology that you have to trick the equipment into being artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Because when you're using the equipment without that, you're getting the image that the engineer designed, not the image that you're trying to create. And we have some very talented, brilliant engineers out there doing this stuff, and they're great. And I know some of them, and they're literally geniuses. They're literally on a different plane than the rest of us.
Yeah.
But they're not artists, and there's that compromise there. So I'm sure that when somebody's making paintbrushes and making paint for a you know a painting type of artist, my wife paints. I think her picture's on the wall behind me. That's one thing. You know, that's where it goes. But what she's going to do with it, what they're going to do with it, that's up to them. So,
you know, as much of a business as this is, as much of a gestalt that exists within each production, there is art that has to come out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And we're storytellers. You know, I've said this millions of times, we are storytellers. How do you interpret an image to tell the story? What I asked Richard on our first go around on Donnie Darko, what is it you want to tell the audience with that image? And I'm a big believer that every element of every frame informs the audience. There is, you know, everybody has a subconscious.
Yep.
And if you can reach that level of subconscious and intellectual communication with an audience, then you've really achieved something.
I think if you're in a dark theater and they don't achieve that, they don't reach it, the audience isn't with you anymore. You know, if when the lights go down, if there isn't something on that screen that takes your head out of that seat and gets you into the story, then you haven't achieved it. You just, and you can tell when that happens. You know, and then you just can. And you can't tell when it doesn't happen. When it just happens organically, you're all there. It's 2020. Hands down, the thing I miss the most is a big movie theater with a large crowd. And that sense of when we all get to that place in our head where we're in this movie with them, you can feel that. You know that somebody five rows behind you is laughing at the same thing you're laughing at, and you're connected.
Yeah.
And that's in the organicness of it. That's in every little detail.
You know, we watched the new Frank Sinatra documentary on Netflix just the other night. Two episodes. It's pretty incredible. I think a lot of it I just have a feeling a lot of the mob stuff was kind of glossed over, but so what? But it was the chronological. It was his life, and it was his ambition, very well done, very well done. But you understood for the first time in history, there was a level of communication that never existed before, and that was called radio. And that radio and those phonograph records created a phenomena where Bobby Soxers, for those who don't know what that is, there's young teenage girls, would scream and faint when they saw him. That was a phenomena that never existed in any other way. And it couldn't have existed because it didn't have the wide reach that radio had. And this suspension of disbelief that these young girls would fantasize about hearing them on a phonograph or a radio, that created a different kind of fandom. And it's gone on and on and on. And of course, we got into early television, and it was very hard to suspend disbelief in television. And then movies. Mass communication has changed everything in such an important way that we're in uncharted waters. We don't know what. When somebody does something over here, how does it affect someone over here? You know, it's a fascinating time in history.
I think some people know, and that's a problem. But, you know, I promise I don't get political on the show. But, yeah, we're in uncharted waters. I know that there's all sorts of possibilities coming. The technology is going to get so hyper real that we're going to have a very hard time telling what's real and what isn't real. And we're already predisposed to go into a movie ready for something that isn't real. So we will accept it. But, we have a responsibility to deal with that properly as the people running the cameras. So now with that, because I know we could do this for another hour, but we may have to do a episode 2 on this one, which would be a first. I'll talk to the producers.
I'd be very pleased to do
that. Yeah, I want to do that, and I want to do an episode 2.
We never got into the industry and the unions and the ASC, and I mean, there's a lot still to talk about.
It's a whole lifetime. We'll get there. We'll get there. But I don't want to lose people. So everybody, plan on an episode 2 down the road as soon as we can. As soon as we can fit one in, I promise we'll do it. So, I would like to thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I miss you. I wish we could hang out in person, but I had to get a podcast just to spend an hour with you, and it was well worth it. So, thank you.
It's a real pleasure, and again, you and I have so much fun on the set together that we've got to do it again soon. Really do.
Nowhere else I would rather be than standing in a dark tent and staring at a screen. So nothing more fun than that. So again, thank you so much for coming on. Be safe. Stay home.
Thank you. You too.
We'll all get through this together. So hang in there.
All right. Good to talk to you.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you. Okay, everybody, just hang on. We'll be right back after this break. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Stephen Poster, for taking the time to talk with us, and you for listening. We're building up a nice archive of shows and have a bunch more on the schedule, so be sure to subscribe. Till next time, be safe, be healthy, and I hope you'll continue to join me on Hollywood, How Did You Get Here?